Hi, it's Ken White.
And it's Josh Barrow, and this is Serious Trouble. Ken, we spoke last week just as the Trump trial in Manhattan was getting started, as they were about to embark on jury selection. Now we're taping. It's early in the second week, which means we're actually into the trial. We've had opening statements. I want to start by talking about what happened last week. It took 3 days in Judge Juan Merchant's courtroom to seat a jury in this case. And I think jury selection is always fascinating for people to watch and, you know, watch this process where the attorneys try to figure out who's favorable to me, who do I keep, who do I strike. First of all, I assume this was very unusual compared to a normal jury selection because every single juror came in with an opinion about the defendant and many of them also had an opinion about the case.
Many did, although, I mean, not having an opinion one way or the other about Donald Trump would seem to me to be something of a matter of concern. I think you'd have to be isolated from the world in an odd way, not to like him or hate him. So it is unusual. I mean, it's a big case. They had questionnaires. They were going much more deeply than many jury selections would go. But the real difference here was that so many of the jurors were concerned about their safety or about what would happen if their names got out as someone on the jury. And the judge expressed concern about that as well. At least one juror, having been selected, expressed concerns and was excused. And the feeling seems to be that it's not safe for whatever reason to be a juror on this, and they're concerned about their identity getting out there. And that's not an unreasonable fear, I think, because really both Trump's team and the press were very vigorously reporting details that could make someone be easily identifiable. And the judge was not happy about that. Judge Merchant scolded the press. I mean, they probably have the First Amendment right to report these details under these circumstances, but the question is whether they should, you know, whether it is, how do you balance the newsworthiness of getting a sense of the type of people who are going to be on the jury with giving details that specifically identify a person so that someone so inclined can go find them?
It seemed to be especially that often in the questioning of the potential jurors, the identities of their current or former employers were disclosed. And that can make it fairly easy to figure out, you know, like corporate lawyer in Manhattan, hard to narrow down, corporate lawyer at some specific firm. And then maybe you know something about the kind of law they practice. Eventually, it becomes possible to figure out who they are. And in fact, the attorneys were figuring out who they are because they would then go and find statements that the potential jurors had made on social media about Donald Trump. Another way in which this trial is unusual. It's not just that the potential jurors have familiarity and opinions about the defendant. A huge fraction of them had made public comments about the defendant. And in some cases, you had the defense or the prosecution saying, you know, well, this thing that we know about this defendant, now that we know something about, you know, the way they've thought about Donald Trump, that affects their impartiality as a juror.
Well, sure. I mean, it's not unusual to have your team scoping out potential jurors' social media presence. That's pretty standard these days. But it is very unusual to have it where you can expect them to have commented about your client on social media specifically before. That doesn't happen a lot. And certainly there was a lot of follow-up by that from Trump's lawyers. Judge Merchant was, I think, mostly reasonable in terms of determining what sounded like something that should require a strike for cause, showing bias, and what didn't. But yeah, I mean, this is not a normal case in any way. Very rarely has almost everybody expressed an opinion about the thing. In kind of a weird way, this harkens back to, you know, when a jury was, you know, not some group of anonymous people you'd never met, but, you know, 12 people from your small town who all knew you and knew about the crime being shoved into a box.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting, the discussion of, you know, what sorts of public comments indicated a bias that made it impermissible for someone to be seated on the jury. You know, they went through there was one juror who had, on when the election was called in 2020, had posted on, I believe it was Facebook, about going outside in Manhattan and hearing all of these people honking their car horns and this celebration. And they bring the potential juror out. And this was one interesting theme for me in the jury selection, is that you had this juror basically trying to make a case for herself and saying, well, I just thought it was a great celebratory moment. And there are people who definitely didn't want to sit on this jury, whether for, you know, concerns about safety or for the ordinary reasons that one might not want to be on jury duty for weeks and weeks. But it also seemed like there were some people there who really did want to sit on this jury, maybe because they had opinions about it, maybe just because it is a super interesting case and it might be an interesting experience to sit on this jury. But you had some of these jurors, potential jurors, who were really trying to argue quite vigorously about how they really could be impartial. They were ready to perform this jury service, which I think is interesting because I think very often people who have jury duty before them would just as soon have the judge decide, yes, you really are unsuitable, you may go.
Yeah, you know, as a rule, lawyers are concerned about jurors who want to be on a jury. So, you know, who you're looking for is probably someone who's somewhat reluctantly doing their civic duty, not someone who, you know, wants to be on this jury, because that's just, you know, that makes them unpredictable and sort of maybe have their own agenda. But you could see why, because, I mean, it is sort of a brush with fame, a brush with notoriety. There's probably a book deal in it afterwards. You know, you're certainly going to get to go on all the shows if that's the way you want to play it after you've served as a juror.
And so that juror, Judge Merchant, decided that was not grounds for a strike for cause. The Trump team then used one of their peremptory challenges to strike her. We'll come back to that in a second. Then the next potential juror comes up, and what the Trump team has found is that he posted on social media, "Get him out and lock him up," about Trump at one point when he was president. And I think fairly reasonably, Judge Merchant decided, yeah, that, you know, if you were posting lock him up on social media, maybe you should not be on this jury. And so that was one of many strikes for cause. Can you describe this process? Because Donald Trump has been complaining about this on his own social media website, saying that he didn't get enough strikes. And so you get to argue before the judge about, you know, the judge should remove this potential juror. And if the judge says no, then you get a fixed number of jurors that you can just remove for any reason. How do you decide how to use those for any reason strikes?
Right. So you got for cause strikes, which are unlimited, and peremptory strikes. The for cause is when there are indications that someone can't serve as a juror, can't be counted on to be, you know, neutral and follow the law and follow the judge's instructions, or, you know, maybe doesn't speak English well or has other things that prevents them from being a juror. The other strikes are at your discretion. Now, they're limited in that nobody is supposed to use them based on race or gender or factors like that. That being said, that happens all the time, and it's often a scandal. And there was just a scandal this week in Oakland about revelations that the DA there had been kicking African-Americans and Jews off of death penalty cases routinely. Hmm. So the defense isn't supposed to do it either. So that's always kind of a factor hanging over all this stuff. But, you know, there are a lot of people who try to gamify this, who try to make it semi-scientific. There have been tons of TV shows where, you know, it's portrayed as scientific. It's really not. I think you can charge a lot of money by pretending it is, but it is more an art than a science. It is about your gut and about your sort of sense of a person. What is someone with this background and this set of circumstances likely to feel about this case? And it always kind of comes down to, you know, the prosecution wants the solid, ideally somewhat boring citizen, and the defense wants the sort of the iconoclast and the free thinker and that type of thing.
And so how do you approach that when you have a criminal defendant that you're representing? How do you figure out who is that iconoclast?
Well, I give my client a lot of input, because I always feel it's important for the client to feel invested in the process. And frankly, their insights may be as good as mine about this type of human behavior. I look to see whether or not someone seems like they're willing to go against the grain, whether they're an independent thinker or whether they're sort of conventional and conservative and likely to just go along. I look for any indications the person might not automatically believe prosecution, police, that type of thing. All of these are things that kind of go into the mix. And then I look for indications that someone, you know, might be very sort of thin blue line culture, very much into whatever the police are the heroes and whatever they say must be right.
The big question that Todd Blanche used, Donald Trump's attorney, and starting off the jury questioning was, what is your opinion of Trump?
Mm-hmm.
And this was interesting in a couple of ways. One was a lot of the potential jurors were pretty coy about it and, you know, would say almost, I mean, some of them literally were attorneys, but sort of they would say lawyerly things about, you know, well, my opinion is every defendant is equal before the system, et cetera, et cetera. But it was interesting because it was, you know, clearly he's trying to tease out people who are politically favorable to the former president. And Judge Merchant seemed somewhat irritated about this line of questioning afterward, although the prosecution didn't object to it. So he didn't stop him from going along with it. But do you think that was a sensible approach, basically, to sort of go out there and try to figure out, you know, who likes Trump, who doesn't like Trump? That's the number one question here.
It's a valid strategy. And the reason is, it's kind of a Rorschach test. You're just throwing it out there and seeing what the response is. So you learn something about the person if they kind of respond with a cliche. You learn something if they sort of dissemble and try to avoid answering the question. So a lot of the times the questions, a lot of the time the voir dire process is about putting your themes out to the jury and trying to forge a connection with the jury for the first time before you even make an opening statement. And so that type of question can fulfill that purpose. But it can also just, you know, you're just throwing something out there and people react to it. And it's not so much the exact question or the exact answer as just the way they react to kind of an open-ended question, see what they do.
In Manhattan, you get a more educated jury pool than you would have in certain other places. And indeed, the jury that was selected in this case is highly educated, as you can infer from the professions that are represented on the jury. You have two lawyers, an investment banker, a retired wealth manager, an engineer, a software engineer, a teacher, a physical therapist, a speech therapist. By my count, 11 of the 12 jurors have or had jobs that would typically require at least a bachelor's degree, in some cases more than a bachelor's degree. Does that create a different trial environment than you might see with a more demographically representative jury?
It does. And whether that's good or bad for the prosecution or the defense really depends on the type of case it is. So on the one hand, a blue-collar jury, traditional thinking is more likely to be sort of law and order and less likely to be prone to questioning the government. Of course, that's flipped often in many cases of race, because, you know, different ethnic groups have different experiences of the police in America. And so you can get very different experiences on that. So, having a more educated jury is kind of the extremes come out. So the more education makes people sometimes more rule following and more prone to go prosecution, or much more iconoclast, much more sort of prone to go out on their own. It kind of it magnifies the outer edges.
So now we have a jury. We have 12 jurors and 6 alternates seated. It took 3 days. That was what Judge Merchant scheduled for and expected. Certainly, you know, compares to, you know, taking nearly a year to get a jury in the Young Thug RICO trial down in Atlanta. That's sort of a preview for how that RICO case involving Donald Trump might go. Was this reasonably efficient in your view?
It was for a case like this, for, you know, this many lawyers involved, for this much press interest, for this many factors like, you know, the press constantly reporting about the jurors. I think it was reasonably efficient. I would have expected it to go a bit longer, but Merchant seems to be running a reasonably tight ship.
We talked about Donald Trump griping about not having enough strikes. The number of peremptory strikes that you get is set in state law in New York, depending on the kind of offense that you're accused of. You get more strikes, the more serious the offense. So it's not, you know, he thought he was supposed to get unlimited strikes, he said. Not only does he not get them, nobody accused of this sort of felony gets unlimited strikes. But he also broadly, you know, seemed upset. And, you know, he's a criminal defendant. It's reasonable to not be enjoying this process.
Right.
But he was pretty sullen through the process. At one point, he was admonished by the judge for sort of muttering about one of the potential jurors. And then I also saw a lot of people commenting on that, you know, when the jury came in and everyone, including his attorneys, stood up to greet the jury, Donald Trump stayed seated. And that's considered bad form?
Very bad form. So, you know, state court is less formal than federal court, but there are some ceremonial and traditional things that are expected. One tends to be that when the jury comes in, everyone, including the judge, stands. And if you don't stand, you really stand out. And I've had to jab more than one client hard in the ribs to get their attention, to get them to stand up, because you really, it looks disrespectful because everyone else is giving this sign of respect. And, you know, the idea is that the jury is the is going to be the judges of the facts. We appreciate their service. We appreciate the time they're sacrificing. They're entitled to some respect. And to kind of deny it is both petty and petulant and almost certainly something the jury notices.
There was also an interesting courtesy that's not being extended here. They were discussing some logistics about witnesses, and the defense asked, well, can you tell us who the first three prosecution witnesses are going to be? And the prosecution said, no, Donald Trump keeps tweeting about the witnesses. We don't want to give him a heads up about who's coming in so we can comment on them. And I guess the Judge Merchan said he wasn't going to order the prosecution to disclose those identities for that reason. Is this normally this is just sort of like a courtesy that's extended that, you know, for things to run smoothly, it's good for people to know what's coming next. And maybe that's a reason to get the defendant to behave.
You know, it differs jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I've heard some lawyers express shock and deep jealousy that we get that type of courtesy in some places, but particularly for longer trials. The judges like it if the parties share who the next day's witnesses are going to be because they perceive correctly that you're going to be more ready and there are fewer delays. Sorry, judge, I just had to pull this exhibit for this cross-examination. Can I have a recess to look at this issue? So on and so forth. So, I mean, it's not required in any jurisdiction's laws that I'm aware of, but it is not uncommon for judges to basically say they expect it. And if you refused and the judge was mad, they could probably do all sorts of things to screw you over, since judges just have vast power to do that during a trial. But it is really bad not to have that when you have a case with lots of witnesses, because it basically means that you as the defense, or during the defense's case as the prosecution, have to be ready on a moment's notice to cross-examine anybody in the case. And that is really hard. Cross-examinations take an immense amount of preparation and effort. It's very hard to stay ready on all of them at once. It's much more feasible to stay primed and ready to go on, say, 2 to 4 of them for the witnesses that are coming the next day. In trial, I'm typically armed with that information, clarifying and editing and reviewing my crosses for the next day. And that makes all the difference in how crisp they are and how successful they are. So this is a bad thing for Trump's lawyers. But I mean, it is not surprising under the circumstances because, yeah, I mean, I'm not out on blue sky attacking the witnesses in the case I'm trying. And if I did, hardly anyone would notice. But, you know, you can see why if someone is consistently attacking witnesses, how the judge would not be inclined to make you reveal them.
Yeah. And what the prosecutors say is not only is what Trump is doing discourteous and a reason that we don't want to disclose this information, they're saying it's a violation of the gag order and the judge should hold him in contempt of court for violating the gag order. So listeners will remember a few weeks ago, because of Donald Trump's persistent public statements attacking various people around him, there was this gag order restricting the way that he may talk about witnesses and jurors and certain other people surrounding the case, including family members of staff. And so Trump has made quite a few public comments. And the prosecution says, you know, there needs to be some sort of sanction for this. They're not asking for him to be put in jail yet. They want fines. They want Judge Merchan to direct him to take down certain posts. And they want the judge to say that jail is an option if he continues to violate the gag order. The line from Trump's side has been basically that, you know, that these people are out there attacking him in the press and that he has a right to respond to them. And, you know, in certain aspects of this, I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, you know, Michael Cohen is literally out there making statements about Donald Trump. Shouldn't Trump be able to call Michael Cohen a liar? I mean, Michael Cohen, first of all, is a liar, which is not to say that he's necessarily going to lie about the specific matters in this case. But also, I mean, when we look back at the purpose of the gag order, which is to prevent intimidation of witnesses so that we can have a fair trial and get the information that the court needs, it doesn't seem to me that Michael Cohen is likely to be intimidated by attacks from Donald Trump. He almost seems to actually relish them.
He does.
It seems to me like an odd result if basically it's that, you know, all of these public people may make claims about Donald Trump in the press about the matter that he's being tried for, and Trump is not allowed to respond to them.
Yeah, I think that is the real problem because, I mean, Michael Cohen the other day, after one of Trump's attacks, put up a tweet that says, hey, Von shits in pants, which is a reference to... which is a reference to rumors that Trump had a flatulence problem during jury selection. Your attacks of me stink of desperation. We're all hoping you take the stand in your defense. I mean, he's absolutely throwing hands on social media at Trump. And yeah, it's more difficult to justify under the somewhat exacting standards for gag orders, that you should prevent Trump from responding to that. Now, during the hearing that's been going on as we've been recording, Judge Merchant has been fairly specific. He's been demanding that Trump's lawyers say, okay, you're saying these are responses, these things the DA has called out. What exactly are they responses to? So Trump the other day published on social media an old statement that Stormy Daniels had written, a declaration when she was still on board with the cover-up, saying, oh no, I never had a relationship with him, that type of thing, saying that he had just found it. And so Judge Merchant was saying, well, this is clearly attacking her credibility and attacking the subject of her testimony. What is this in response to? He wound up, Judge Merchant, being fairly blunt, some would say brutal, to Todd Blanche, the lead attorney for Trump, basically saying, you're not giving me any authority. Your arguments are kind of dumb. And, you know, you're not persuading me. He's, as we record, the judge has taken this issue under consideration. He's taken it under submission as to how he's going to rule. But
so that means he's not going to rule from the bench today?
At least not right now. Might be later in the day, conceivably. But he showed a considerable amount of skepticism towards Trump's position that he's allowed to respond. And he was also very skeptical that his responses should be classified as political as opposed to about the case. So, you know, he was analyzing the Avenatti tweet that we talked about a couple episodes ago when Avenatti was saying, you know, Cohen and Stormy Daniels are terrible and the First Amendment allows Trump to respond to them. And, you know, basically all the ways for Avenatti to be desperate for attention and in prison. And
because Trump had reshared that. That's why this is relevant here.
Right. And praised it and thanked Avenatti. And so the judge is saying, well, wait, how is this not being part of a questioning the credibility of witnesses based on what they're about to testify to? So, as you said, the government's only asking for a fine this time, but people's read of the hearing that went on as we recorded this was that it was sounding as if Judge Merchant was inclined to fine him in contempt for at least some of the statements. As I said, this does not seem to be going well for Trump or his lawyers. At one point, Judge Merchant said to Todd Blanche, Trump's attorney, you're losing all credibility. I have to tell you right now, you're losing all credibility with the court. Not a great lawyer moment, but you know, it happens.
Let's get to the opening statements, because this is, you know, we're getting into the meat of the trial. And so the prosecution is basically saying, you know, this was an illegal scheme to interfere with an election, that they were trying to keep information away from voters that voters would have found relevant. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's politics, but that they did certain illegal things along the way to doing that. There's this New York law that prohibits the falsification of business records, which is a misdemeanor, but it's a felony if you do it in furtherance of an underlying crime. And so there's this claim that the hush money payment was an illegal campaign contribution, that it was both unreported and excessive. There's also a claim that they made misrepresentations on tax filings by disguising the hush payment as a payment for labor. And one odd thing we've talked about is, you know, that actually probably increased their tax liability, but the tax law says you can't intentionally lie to the tax authorities, even if the lie causes you to owe more in taxes. So there's that theory. And then there's also a New York state election law about that you can't use unlawful means to try to influence an election. And that sort of circularly goes back onto the federal offense, that if you make an excessive federal campaign contribution, they're saying that's also a crime under New York state law. And that bumps the falsification of business records up to a felony. The defense is basically that, you know, this case relies on Michael Cohen. You can't trust Michael Cohen. These really were payments for legal services. And they're also basically saying that, you know, this stuff is politics. And they're trying to criminalize politics here. And that, you know, that's not what the criminal code is for. What did you make of these openings?
Well, they show two very different approaches. The prosecution's approach is telling a story. And, you know, my classmate and friend of the show, Mitch Epner, commented how this kind of illustrates the adage that facts don't persuade, stories do. And so they're kind of putting all this into the context of a series of events that tell a story. And so a lot of it was, in effect, slights on Trump's character. His, you know, his character for not paying his bills went into why he would structure things a particular way. You know, his narcissism and vanity went into why he would try to quash these stories and things like that. And so they're telling the story. The defense is much more, this is all BS and you can't trust these witnesses. So the defense repeatedly specifically attacked Michael Cohen, as one would, and actually drew objections that were sustained by the judge for saying that he was a perjurer and trying to go into his criminal case.
Why is that not allowed?
Well, the theory is that the way he was doing it and trying to delve into the facts underlying the perjury conviction was inappropriate at this stage. So it's kind of showing the different burdens they have. The defense only has to point that there's not proof beyond reasonable doubt, and the prosecution has to do the whole thing. They have to tell the whole story, prove every element. Everyone thought that both sides did well in stating their cases, but the government really seems to be leaning primarily on the theory of the election interference. This somewhat circular theory that he falsified the records to promote the crime of election interference, which is a crime of interfering with an election by unlawful means, which was the falsification of the records.
Well, which was the falsification of records and also was the federally illegal campaign contribution, or what they theorize is a campaign contribution under federal law. One of the, you know, the defense would dispute that this was a campaign expense at all, and in fact would say that, you know, if you tried to have your campaign pay for the hush payment, that would be illegal because it would be a personal expense paid by the campaign. But in any case, there's sort of two theories of what the underlying illegal act could be under that state law about election interference.
Yeah, and I think what the government is counting on is what we've talked about before, that juries tend to look at things somewhat holistically. They tend to accept the story or not accept the story. And in my view, if they come up with facts or specific factual holes, that tends to be sort of an afterthought. Well, I didn't buy the story, and oh, I guess I didn't buy the story because XYZ. So I think the government's counting on the jury not thinking too hard about the particular theory of the case or how it may be circular.
I just have this viscerally negative reaction to the use of this term election interference to describe what the offense is supposed to be here, because this is a term that's been thrown around a lot over the last 6 or 7 years and sort of in two contexts. One has to do with foreign entities trying to influence U.S. elections, which there are laws significantly restricting their ability to do that. Not just a foreign government, but even a foreign person does not have the same rights to contribute money and spend money in U.S. elections the way that a domestic person does. And the other has had to do with efforts to actually interfere in vote counts. You know, Donald Trump calling up Georgia and saying, find me 11,000 votes. This is basically a theory that they interfered with the election by changing the way that voters cast their valid legal votes. Basically that, you know, by causing people to not know something about Donald Trump that they otherwise might have known, that interfered, quote unquote, with the election result by causing certain people to vote for Trump who might otherwise have voted for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, that's really core political activity. That is what, you know, what we do in elections is try to influence the way that voters act. And not even all of that has to be done under the auspices of a campaign organization. You know, if you're a media outlet or you're someone who writes in newspapers or even comments on social media, you can go out there and try to influence the election, interfere in the result of the election, and you don't even have to file a report with the FEC about that. Now, I understand there's this underlying theory of a campaign finance violation. Now, I'd note it's a theory that federal prosecutors chose not to prosecute.
Right.
And that's normally how this sort of thing would be handled. You know, it's a federal election. You'd have a federal, either a civil action or a criminal action around it. But we don't normally talk about campaign finance law violations in terms of quote unquote election interference. We just, you know, we talk about them as campaign finance violations. It feels like this weird effort to smuggle in certain other activities that were illegal for other reasons or that were, you know, a public policy problem for other reasons and apply it to something that, you know, at least has strong elements of being really core political activity of trying to influence people to vote for you.
Yeah, I admit that I'm uncertain about that too. And I think a large component here is just the sort of the fever, you know, we've got him this time and we've got to get him on something and he's skated on so much stuff and there has to be something and this is something and therefore we're going with it. I agree with you that this would, I mean, if used aggressively, capture a lot of political behavior, both lying about and trying to conceal things about yourself, which all candidates do, or even, you know, aggressively going after information about the opposing candidate. So some of the scenarios I thought about is, let's say I'm running for the Senate and I send one of my kids to rehab and I send him under a false name so the press doesn't find out, you know, that I just commit a felony in New York.
Or at least a misdemeanor by falsifying the business record.
Well, but a felony if my intention is to keep from the voters the information that I have a kid in rehab.
Oh,
or,
yes.
you know, if you pay a bribe to someone to leak some information, is that now a felony under the statute if you, you know, convince people to reveal information? So I would be concerned about how it could be used. And I think that the problem is that, you know, Trump's argument is that I'm being singled out for a very aggressive exercise of this statute that would not normally be done. And on that, I think he's right. I mean, I don't think there's really any prospect that anyone who didn't have a background like his, who didn't have sort of a career of lawlessness like him, that they wouldn't go after him like this. Now, that's the way they go after high-profile people. It always has been. Al Capone's taxes were not necessarily the type of tax violations that would normally have been investigated and prosecuted. But, you know, the specter hanging over all of this is that, yeah, they are somewhat, they are signaling him out by, you know, they found this theory that's very aggressive and they're going with it.
Yeah. And I mean, just to remember the history, the original way that the Manhattan DA was looking into Donald Trump had to do with the matters that ultimately became the attorney general's civil action. These business matters about inflating or depressing claims about the value of assets and, you know, the square footage of Donald Trump's apartment and all of these things, the idea that this was fraud on certain financial institutions, they ultimately decided they couldn't make that as a criminal case. The attorney general successfully brought it as a civil action, which has a lower standard of proof. And a lot of people were really mad at District Attorney Alvin Bragg when he came into office and shut down that investigation that had been conducted by his predecessor. And then, you know, after a lot of criticism around that, and after Alvin Bragg faced a lot of political difficulty, like many DAs around the country on unrelated matters to do with, you know, increased violent crime in New York, and was he being aggressive enough, they sort of dug under the couch cushions and they found this other theory on this other, you know, this other action that had not been at the top of the list of, you know, what are Donald Trump's bad, you know, what are his criminal acts, and came up with, as you note, this quite aggressive theory. I think there's also this odd situation that, and Jed Sugarman, who's a law professor at Boston University, has an interesting op-ed in the New York Times this week that we'll link to about the aggressiveness of these theories about the underlying campaign finance violation. Maybe the cleanest legal theory that the state has here is actually their other one, which is that there's an underlying tax violation. As I noted, you know, if you take a hush payment and you instead mischaracterize it as labor income to your attorney, then that changes the amount of tax due. Now, it changes it upward, but that's not necessarily material in the same way that, you know, if you lie to a bank on a loan application, the bank doesn't actually have to lose money for that to be a crime.
Right.
They may have a cleaner legal case here about that he falsified business records in furtherance of this tax violation where they misreported tax information to the New York State tax authorities. But that doesn't make a very good story for the jury.
It does not.
Because both it is, you know, it's not about this big matter of consequence, the election, and there isn't even a harmed party.
Right.
There's not even money that the state of New York lost as a result of it, but it might be the cleaner legal theory.
I think you're right that it might be the cleanest theory, but I also think it's very unappealing to a jury. It's not a story that moves them, particularly with a total lack of loss issue. You know, tell a jury, we're going to tell you the story about how a guy falsified business records so he'd have to pay more taxes. You know, that doesn't grab them out of the gate.
We'll leave it there on the trial for this week. And, you know, we've already had our first witness, David Pecker, but we're going to talk about when we've had a number of witnesses testify. We're going to come back and do our update on how the trial is going. There's also some Bob Menendez news that we'll cover in the next episode. But Ken, one thing that I want to do before we go, because I love this so much and I love how you don't love it. George Santos, back in the news with his lawsuit against the Walt Disney Company. I guess they had a pretrial conference and George Santos was psyched because he got to go to court for a reason other than that he's on criminal trial. in case anyone could possibly have forgotten this, George Santos is on Cameo. You can hire him to send birthday and anniversary wishes to your loved ones. Jimmy Kimmel, under various false names, hired him to record ridiculous messages about furries and that sort of thing, and then broadcast them on his show on ABC. And George Santos is waving around the license that comes with any Cameo and saying, this did not give you the right to take the Cameo and broadcast it on TV. It was for personal use. I want to be paid for the labor that I did producing this intellectual property for you that you then violated the license. And so there's a scheduling hearing, and Santos is extremely irritated that Jimmy Kimmel did not show up for this hearing. What kind of disrespect to the court is that Jimmy Kimmel didn't even go to the scheduling conference?
This fucking Cousin Oliver. I'm just going to have this guy wrapped around my neck for the rest of this podcast, aren't I? So, yeah, George Santos, the longer this goes, the more clear it is that the primary purpose of this case is self-promotion for George Santos and giving him opportunities to caper around exactly like he's doing here. So, you know, the answer to George Santos is no client goes to a scheduling hearing in a civil case. That's a thing for lawyers. It's deadly boring. Nothing of substance happens other than the judge setting dates. And there's no reason Kimmel would be there. It would be very weird, deeply weird for him to be there. And George Santos was there just because George Santos wants to get on camera, as you said, in context, not involving him potentially going to federal prison. So the only thing we really learned is the completely unsurprising point that Kimmel is going to use a fair use defense, the defense that he was permitted under the law to make these uses on TV of these cameos because they are for satire and parody and news commentary and that type of thing, which I have to say is not a easy defense. But what's clear is Santos is going to continue to use this case to get his face on camera and to take shots at Jimmy Kimmel and try to draw people into fights that attract attention to him in a non-criminal context.
I mean, you know, he could have more than one objective. He might like damages and attention. Who doesn't like money and attention?
Well, you know, it's entirely possible by the time this case is drawing to a trial, he's going to be in federal prison. So I don't really like his chances necessarily of prevailing in the long run.
How does that work if you're the plaintiff in a civil suit and you're in prison? I assume you can't get out of prison to go attend it, or can you?
Well, you might convince the judge to issue a writ. Might be a writ ad testificandum, I believe, is the Latin to haul. And sometimes they use that to
That's near the taint, the testificandum?
Well played. Well played. And they use that sometimes to bring in a prisoner who's going to testify against another defendant or something like that. But theoretically, you could probably get a judge to have you brought and kept in lockup during a civil trial, though that's complicated because a lot of times, you know, in some cases, they don't have the civil and criminal courtrooms in the same building. So, but here with federal court, it should be easier.
Yeah. We'll be watching the developments in the trial and coming back to you when we have plenty of news to share. We'll figure out when the right time is for that. But also, we would love your questions. This is certainly, you know, a fascinating process, and I have a lot of questions, and I'd love to hear what questions you have. Ken, if people have questions, where should they send them?
Straight to hell, Josh. But barring that, to RicoHotline@SeriousTrouble.show.
For Ben Dreyfuss's benefit, could you take that last part again? What comes after the dot?
Ben, it's dot show, S-H-O-W.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Josh.
Serious Trouble is created and produced by Very Serious Media. That's me and Sarah Fay. Jennifer Swadek mixed this episode. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosier. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with more soon.
See you next time.